abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, November 5th, 2013. Tom Woods here. We're going to do some more myth-busting for you today. Today, we have another international topic. Now, you'll notice that so far, we've covered Somalia and Sweden in terms of other countries. Because Americans, particularly Americans of a particular political persuasion, always like to pick some country somewhere else in the world and say, look, this country has a huge government sector, and it's doing great. So quit worrying and quit grousing. It'll be great if our overlords have more power over us, right? Wouldn't that be great? Look at how great it is for these other countries. So, or conversely, in the case of Somalia, look how terrible it is. There aren't enough overlords there. They need more overlords. So what I want to do is give you guys the response to these situations. You're going to get these thrown in your faces. So we covered Sweden, and if you missed that program, go to the archive at tomwoodsradio.com or subscribe on iTunes or on Stitcher and scroll back and find that program. And I also put up a resource page for when you are in this situation of a bunch of articles that will help you refute the Sweden example. So that's libertyclassroom.com/Sweden. libertyclassroom.com/Sweden will give you all the information you need on that. So we've done Somalia and Sweden. Tomorrow we're going to do Australia, because I've had a lot of people say, hey, my friends keep sending me these memes where they say, look, Australia's got this high minimum wage and they have low unemployment. So that just goes to show that, you know, high minimum wages are awesome for employment and all that. So we're going to talk to somebody from Australia. We're going to talk to an economist in Australia tomorrow, so we can get to the bottom of that. But today it's Denmark. And if you think, well, Denmark, what difference does Denmark make to me? I don't know anything about Denmark, and Denmark doesn't get raised in conversation much. But yes, actually it does. A couple weeks ago, there was an article in the Huffington Post that got a lot of traction on Facebook. And as a matter of fact, this article was really just building on some research that provoked a lot of articles in a lot of outlets, but we saw the Huffington Post one because we're the U.S., and for some reason everybody reads the Huffington Post. And what they found was that Denmark is the happiest country, whatever that means. Denmark is the happiest country in the world. And here's why. And they went on and just came up with their own theories as to why. Well, because they have a big government, and they have a big welfare state, and all these various government benefits. So who wouldn't be happy under these conditions is the argument that we saw in that article. And I had people begging me to respond to this, and I'm sorry we're a little bit late, but better late than never. I want to bring onto the program right now a professor from Denmark, Christian Bjørnskov. He's a full professor in the Department of Economics at Aarhus University, where he has been since 2005. And he's written for a great many professional journals. He has a CV as long as my arm. And I brought him on here because he's familiar with the so-called happiness research. And, of course, he's familiar with Denmark. So, Christian Bjørnskov, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you taking some time to be with us today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, let's start off before getting into the details about Denmark and the claims that were made in this notorious Huffington Post article, which very, very rapidly made the rounds on Facebook recently. First of all, tell us, what exactly is this happiness literature? What are some of the assumptions behind it? And also, it seems to be relatively new. Like, what exactly is it?
Well, it's about 20 years old, the modern literature on happiness. And the main assumption is that people know best themselves. So instead of trying to set up an index of what we think people ought to like, what we think a good life ought to be, we ask people themselves. So we don't ask people what makes you happy. We ask them, how happy are you these days? Or how satisfied are you with your life as a whole? And when we have questions from literally 100,000 people, it's pretty easy to go back and see what's common to the very happy people. What makes them happy? And so what makes some Americans happier than other Americans, and what makes Danes happier than Americans?
Now, how do you measure happiness? It seems like a difficult thing to grab hold of conceptually.
It is, but it, as it turns out, the simplest question is the best measure. The question is, on a scale from 1 to 10, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole? That's a good question, because it doesn't leave anything specific to answer. It doesn't presume that we know what makes you happy. So people will answer that in an honest way, because we haven't asked about anything that triggers any social norms, for example, anything that people say, oh, this makes me happy because they think that it ought to make them happy. It gives us the most precise answers.
Well, it does seem like maybe a question you might be more likely to get an answer that's valid across cultures. I think, for example, of sometimes when Korean children are asked, are you good at mathematics? A lot of them will say no, and yet most American kids will say they are good at mathematics and they're terrible at it. And that indicates in both cases some cultural assumptions there about what it means to be good at math and the expectations that your parents have. But just simply asking, are you happy? Well, it does seem, at least on the surface of it, plausible that we might be able to compare the answers from one country to another. But now, of course, the reason I brought you on, it's not simply at random. I don't think I've ever dialed a telephone number in Denmark before. It's the first time for me. It's specifically the finding that Denmark is the happiest country. And of course, right away, there are political implications of this, because you know as well as anybody that Denmark has a very substantial public sector, and so it didn't take very long for people to draw what they consider to be the appropriate conclusion. What do you make of Denmark coming out on top of this happiness ranking?
Well, it actually makes sense if you know the literature, but it's not due to the reasons that the Huffington Post claims and that are published all over the world. It doesn't have anything to do with the public sector or with the massive welfare state that we share with Sweden and Norway. If you compare things across countries, what happens is that it's mainly due to something quite different. It's due to the very high levels of social trust. So we don't really trust our politicians more than you guys do, but we trust other people way more than anyone else in the world. So if you ask questions like, in general, do you think most people can be trusted, or do you have to be careful? Roughly 40% of Americans say yes. The global average is 27%. If you go to Denmark, 70% say yes, you can trust other people. So with that level of trust, there are a lot of worries that you just don't have to have in Denmark. You feel safe with other people.
What do you attribute that to? That's an extraordinary figure.
It's an extraordinary figure, and we don't really know where it came from. But what we can see is, for example, among third-generation immigrants in the U.S., they still have more or less the same trust as their grandparents had when they immigrated from Denmark or Norway or Sweden. It survives throughout generations. And that makes it very difficult to say where it actually came from. We know that communism destroys trust. So we know that it's possible to destroy trust in other people. But we don't really know how to build it. But we can see its consequences quite clearly in happiness, in the quality of legal systems, in how much or how little corruption you have. Those are all good consequences, but we don't know how to create them.
Now, when you say that this really gets to the core of why Denmark comes out at the top in terms of happiness, is this just an educated guess on your part, or do you feel like you have good, rigorous social scientific data to back this up, that this really is the explanatory factor?
My first scientific paper in an international journal was about this issue. And I've been working on that for the last 10 years on and off. Several other people, including John Helliwell, who co-authored the last World Happiness Report, has been working on that and found the same thing. We also know that that characterizes parts of the differences between happiness across the U.S. states. So a state like Minnesota is happier than a state like, say, Mississippi, because trust levels are way higher in Minnesota than in Mississippi.
And you've done, as you say, scholarly work on this question of trust, and yet it's still sort of elusive as to how to account for why one area, I mean, there's nothing about cultural homogeneity that might account for the higher levels of trust?
No, we used to think that ethnically diverse countries would probably be less trusting. What we now know is that they're not. We also know that ethnically diverse American states are not more or less trusting. What we know is that states with a larger African-American population are less trusting. But that's for obvious reasons. That is literally centuries of oppression that you eventually see in the trust measures. So there's a lot of different historical factors that have shaped trust over the years. But at the end of the day, you pass on your trust level to your children. If nothing dramatic happens to them, they pass the same trust level on to their children. And that way it just survives across generations.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, though, let's nevertheless revisit this Huffington Post article, just because I do want to review with listeners the kinds of claims that are made by American left liberals. And by the way, tomorrow I'm going to be talking to somebody from Australia, because Americans are saying Australia has a high minimum wage, Australia seems to have robust employment figures, therefore we should have a high minimum wage. The Americans are just so eager to chase after whatever they perceive to be some fad in some other country that they think they can summarize all of Swedish history in two sentences, for example. So with Denmark, for example, the first item in this Huffington Post article is Denmark supports parents. They say that Danish families get a total of 52 weeks of parental leave, and they get free or low-cost child care. They get health and well-being consideration in terms of early childhood education. All these sorts of factors, they say, well, surely anybody who lives in a society like this would be happy. How do you respond to that?
Well, what we know from the last like 10 years of research is that people adjust their expectations. So a lot of material improvements don't give us any happiness in the long run, because you might be better off, you buy a larger car, and 1 year later, you've gotten used to that car, because that's just what a car does. What the welfare state does, it gives us some material improvements that we haven't chosen for ourselves. We know that those kinds of improvements are the improvements that we get used to the fastest. So they can't give us any lasting or permanent higher happiness, because we just adjust our expectations. So in Denmark, we have high unemployment benefits, we have the 52-week maternity leave, and that's just what we expect to get. It doesn't do anything permanently for our happiness level. What it does is that the 52-week maternity leave leaves mothers behind in the employment queue. It's actually damaging to their career in the long term.
All right, now that's interesting. Now I understand that's an excellent point about happiness, which I hadn't thought of, that you adjust your expectations. And so mere material improvements don't mean you're going to be happier in the long run. It means your expectation level is now at a higher plateau. But now in terms of the maternity leave, this is an interesting point. Now, are there other scholars in Denmark who are pointing this out? I mean, surely Denmark has a very strong feminist movement. Do they not notice that being absent from the workforce for a year has a long-term effect on a professional woman?
Well, the problem is that the Danish feminist movement has its roots in Marxist movements from the 1960s and 1970s. So there is a divide. There's also a generational gap between the old feminists and some of the new feminists. And the new Danish feminists quite clearly realized that the maternity leave and a number of other labor market regulations are actively damaging the equality between the genders. They're damaging to women's careers. But it's a politically quite sensitive issue, because once you've given people a 52-week maternity leave, they expect that as a right, not as a gift.
Well, let's move on to the next claimed right that makes Danes happy. Health care is a civil right, we read here. It says, Danish citizens expect and receive health care as a basic right. And what's more, they know how to effectively use their health systems. They're in touch with their primary care physician an average of nearly 7 times per year. Now, again, I understand why this, too, for the same reason, can't be the explanatory factor behind the happiness results. But still, from an American standpoint, the Americans might well say, all right, well, forget about happiness. What we care about is material well-being. And Denmark shows that you can have this substantial welfare state and still have a fairly robust and competitive economy. Now, as somebody living in Denmark who is an economist, what would you say to an American audience that's convinced of this?
Well, I would go with the Heritage Foundation that last year characterized Denmark as a schizophrenic nation. So in the Economic Freedom Index that they publish every year, Denmark has almost exactly the same score as the U.S., but with a much, much larger public sector. The public sector is financed because if you look at other parts of the Danish society, they are way more capitalist than the U.S. Property rights protection is among the finest in the world. The monetary approach is very, very stable. Labor markets are more or less deregulated. So closed shop regulation that we know from a number of American states is actually illegal in Denmark. What is obvious to people is the large welfare state. What's not obvious is the super capitalist institutions protecting the welfare state.
Well, you know, I had a scholar on a few weeks ago talking about Sweden, and one of the points he made is that in the decades before the Swedish welfare state really took off, Sweden benefited from the fact that it had a largely free market, it had stayed out of war, and so it had a tremendous capital to draw on for the welfare state. Does Denmark have a similar history?
Yes. Denmark was the fourth richest country in the world in the mid-1930s. We're now about number 15. So we're dropping slowly in the rankings. But until around 1960, Denmark was a very, very liberal country in the European sense of the word. Taxes were lower than in the U.S., regulations were easy, and the legal system was still protecting property rights very well. That gave us the wealth upon which we could build a welfare state. And we've been able to finance that through a couple of crises by reforming parts of it and maintaining what actually works.
Is your impression that the Danish welfare state is more or less remaining stable, or is it in a mild decline, or is it expanding? Where exactly is it in the dynamics?
It's in a mild decline, I would say. We recently reduced the unemployment, the benefit duration period. So you can now get unemployment benefits for 2 years instead of four. After 2 years, you go on the dole, which is much less money. And we do know that we have a massive problem with an entire generation that's about to retire. That's going to be extremely important to figure out ways to finance that generation in terms of health benefits, in terms of pensions, and in terms of the very substantial claims they make on the welfare state. So there is a push in Danish politics towards trying to reform parts of the welfare state, and we are looking at Sweden, where, for example, they have introduced vouchers in their schooling system, and that seems to work really, really well.
Let me read you a passage that really surprised me And then I'll tell you why I find it surprising, and maybe you can tell me why it shouldn't be surprising. Denmark is a society where citizens participate and contribute to making society work. More than 40% of all Danes do voluntary work in cultural and sports associations, NGOs, social organizations, political organizations, etc. There is a wealth of associations. In 2006, there were 101,000 Danish organizations, worth noting in a population of just 5.5 million. Now, the reason that surprises me is that I would tend to be of the impression that a large welfare state or a large public sector in general would tend to encourage among the population the idea that, you know, anything that's charitable or anything that's outside the market nexus is being taken care of by the public sector, so you don't need to worry about it. And yet here we have big public sector, big welfare state Denmark, and yet a lot of volunteering going on. How do we make sense of that?
Well, it depends on what kind of volunteering we're talking about. The joke is that if two Danes meet, they'll have a cup of coffee. If three Danes meet, they're going to form an association. We have this amazing history of having a really, really strong civil society that dates back to the 19th century. But if you look at contributions to charity, the average American contributes 11 times more than the average Dane. What we do is that we form tennis clubs, football clubs, choirs, and so on. But actual charitable work is mostly done either by the state or financed by the state. So about half of all Danish development aid, official Danish state development aid, is funneled through the NGOs. So they're not really non-government. They're semi-government organizations. And that, unfortunately, also goes for a lot of charitable work, except for what certain organizations do with homeless people, because they don't fit into the boxes of the welfare state.
So, in other words, the passage I just read is extremely misleading.
It's misleading in the sense that we have an incredibly strong civil society, but it's not doing charity. It's doing all sorts of other things that people value.
All right, so in our closing moments, suppose you are speaking to the United States, and most Americans know pretty much nothing about Denmark. Okay, that's just a fact. They know nothing whatsoever about Denmark. So if they read one article about how awesome Denmark is because their 52-week maternity leave program and this, that, and the other thing, they're liable to think, wow, I know all there is to know about Denmark. How would you, in just a couple of minutes, try to explain, you know, just give people an overview of what the real pluses and minuses are of the Danish system?
Well, the pluses are that it is like a small, rich country populated by people from Minnesota. They might not be the most exciting people in the world, but you can trust them. So the pluses are that the high levels of trust and an incredibly strong sense that if something's wrong in your life, you can always do something yourself. So 94% of all Danes say, sure, I can change things in my life. That's about 10 percentage points higher than the U.S. It's also about having a very fair, effective, and completely politically independent legal system, which I think some U.S. states could benefit from having. The downside is that we, for some reason, have built an incredibly large welfare state that now takes up about half of the economy. So the average, not rich, but middle-class person pays a marginal tax of 56%. So that's not, it's not important to happiness. It's not important to becoming a wealthier or healthier society. But so it doesn't do anything. It doesn't give you what it promises. But we can do that because all the institutions are there to finance it if we want. The trick is that it's all the things that you don't see in Denmark that creates happiness, that creates the most satisfied country in the world. The great legal system, the incredibly competitive political system, so we have 8 parties in parliament, and that level of trust that means that you can play golf with your garbage collector it doesn't matter because you still think he's a decent bloke. So if you see Denmark as the happiest country in the world, it's true, but it's not for the reason you think.
Well, suppose you had a crystal ball then, and I wanted you to look in it and tell me, if I were to revisit this and look at Denmark 20 years from now, do you expect Denmark to be much different, mildly different, or the same?
I would expect that you would find a country with a slightly smaller welfare state, but more or less the same. But you would probably think that the citizens of Denmark were awfully spoiled.
Okay. Well, that is that's a good insight, and I much appreciate the information today. I mean, there's just no way, as somebody living in the U.S., I would have known this stuff, having no real knowledge of Denmark. I know a little bit about Sweden, but I knew something was fishy about this article, and I'm so glad that we were able to track you down and come on here and help correct some of these false impressions. So, Professor, thanks so much again for your time.
Great talking to you.
All right, everybody, so another myth has been smashed here on The Tom Woods Show. And, you know, it's funny, this whole matter about trusting people and that the trust levels are higher in Denmark than they are in the U.S., it's just interesting to note that right around this very time, just the other day, I posted at my personal site, tomwoods.com, a blog post about Halloween and Halloween candy. And right, what are we all told happens on Halloween? Well, bad people, they take out their syringes and they inject poison into candy and then they hand it out to kids. Now, I mean, you would think that would kind of tend to lead back to your house, right? I mean, kids tend to trick-or-treat only in a particular neighborhood. It seems kind of a risky way to poison people, but that's what we're told. They're going to poison your kids, right? They poison your kids constantly. You can't trust anybody. Poison candy everywhere. And apparently up to a quarter of parents are seriously worried about poison candy. Well, so I posted an article just the other day at tomwoods.com. I saw this article a few days late after Halloween, but it turns out the one person, a guy named Joel Best, who's a professor who happens to be the world's foremost expert on so-called poison Halloween candy, says there's no such thing. This is just a made-up problem. He says you cannot find an example of a guy going up to some stranger's house on Halloween, some kid, getting candy and then dropping dead from poison candy. He can't find any example of this on record, and he has scoured the record. So just on the matter of trust, I found that to be kind of an interesting item. A couple more quick things before we get out of here today. All you Bitcoin people, I'm taking Bitcoin now at libertyclassroom.com, and I'm also giving away free books in the coming days. So if you join libertyclassroom.com, which is the best, most important thing I have ever done, which if you have not checked out, please do as a personal favor to me, at libertyclassroom.com, where you can learn the history and economics they didn't teach you, I am giving away free signed personalized copies of my book, Nullification. So you sign up and then you drop me a note on our contact page, send me your address along with the note, hey, you bum, I just signed up, where's my book? And we'll ship that baby right on out to you. And finally, remember, I am going to be all over the place this month. It looks like we have indeed finalized events at Clarion University in Pennsylvania for November 18th, November 19th, Penn State, and November 20th at lunchtime, St. Louis University School of Law, and then in the afternoon, Lindenwood University in St. Charles, Missouri. I have the details for the latter two up at tomwoods.com/events, and I'll have the other two, the logistical details, up just as soon as I can possibly get them up, as soon as I find them out, also at tomwoods.com/events. Help us out. Enter Amazon. We're going to make your purchases by going to tomwoodsradio.com and entering Amazon from there. And subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. Let's get us up there on the charts on those places. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll smash the myth of Australia tomorrow. See you around.
The Tom Woods Show.